Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Chronic Fatigue and Burnout Recovery Podcast. Today I'm going to be talking about heart rate variability. Heart rate variability being a biomarker that you can now measure using a watch or an app or a smartphone or a wearable device that can give you some insight into the state of your autonomic nervous system and therefore the day-to-day fluctuating levels of resilience and capacity. Often on Instagram, I get people reaching out and asking me questions about heart rate variability. What are the best devices to use? What are the best numbers? How do they know if their heart rate variability is good or bad? And obviously, how can we improve it as an indicator of greater capacity within the nervous system? So that's what I would really like to unpack here today. If you've never heard of the concept of heart rate variability, I'll talk a little bit about what that is specifically and how it's useful generally and in chronic health conditions more specifically. And then also how to use the data in a way that is meaningful as you navigate your chronic illness experience. I obviously don't have experience with all of the different devices by which you can measure heart rate variability, but I do have experience with some of the devices, and I'll share a little bit of my personal experience with the devices that I've used. And then we'll talk about things that I've observed in myself and with clients that can help to improve heart rate variability and therefore hopefully offer more capacity in terms of being able to do more and achieve more and just live more day to day as you navigate your healing experience. So before I go into the full episode, I will say that I didn't actually want to talk about this myself. I'm really looking to get more guests onto the podcast and have different voices apart from my own. Although some people do say they really love listening to my voice on this podcast, maybe that's not the case for everyone. And it is nice just to have some more dynamic conversations instead of monologues with myself. So I did actually reach out to Harry, who is the founder of the Visible app, which is a heart rate variability tracking app, which is specific for people with chronic illness like ME, CFS, and long COVID. We were supposed to record an interview a couple of weeks ago. Unfortunately, due to his own health, he needed to postpone that appointment. But I am hoping we will find a compatible time in the future, and I'll get him on the show to talk more about heart rate variability and the Visible app specifically. But until then, you'll just have to put up with me talking about heart rate variability today. But I'm sure there'll still be some really nice insights and perhaps even just validating perhaps what you've already discovered from your own personal journey with heart rate variability. So let's start at the beginning. It's always a good place to start, which is, what is heart rate variability? Well, as the name suggests, or as it says on the tin, heart rate variability is the variation of time between each heartbeat. And so the heart actually doesn't beat like a metronome. Instead, some of our heartbeats are closer together and some of our heartbeats are further apart. So let's just say average heartbeat is 60 beats per minute. If the heart was beating like a metronome, that would mean every second on the second the heart would beat. But in fact, what actually happens is that the heart might beat at 0.8 seconds, and then 0.9 seconds, and then 1.3 seconds, and then 0.7 seconds, and then 1.1 seconds. So essentially what I've just described is that there is a variability in the space between each heartbeat. And this variability can then give us insight into what is happening with the nervous system, specifically the autonomic nervous system, which is responsible for eliciting the survival responses, fight, flight, and freeze. So if the heart rate is more metronomic, in the context that it's more rhythmic, there's less variability between heartbeats, then this is usually a sign of an increased sympathetic physiology. So an increase in sympathetic activation, an increase in fight or flight physiology. If the heart rate variability is less metronomic, so there is more variation between our heartbeats, this can be an indicator of greater parasympathetic tone. So the body is in a greater sense of rest and digest. And this is ultimately the state that we need to be in to recover, to repair, and ultimately for the cells in our body to heal. So most people who are navigating some sort of chronic illness experience, they know that they need to spend more time in parasympathetic tone and less time in sympathetic tone, because we almost need to do more or spend more time in a healing state to overcompensate for the balances which have been created from not being in a healing state, from probably being stressed for a very long time, for too long. So if we have a tool like heart rate variability, which can give us an indicator of what state we're in, are we more parasympathetic, are we more sympathetic, then we can use this tool perhaps as a little bit of a guide as to what is going on in the body. And we can track progress, we can make judgment calls about what we do each day, we can see perhaps what foods or supplements are supportive or not supportive. So just by having some sort of external tool, it can be very helpful in the decision-making process and the management process when it comes to supporting your body through a chronic illness and improving quality of life. So that kind of brings us on to the next question, which is, how is heart rate variability useful in chronic fatigue? And I would put here just chronic illness generally. It doesn't only have to be a chronic fatigue state. And I think my top three reasons are, first of all, because we can get an assessment of this autonomic nervous system regulation or dysregulation. We can get a sense of the indicators of chronic stress on the body, and we can essentially get a baseline. So we have a baseline, we understand maybe what our heart rate variability is day to day, or some of the devices will get you to track, for example, first thing in the morning or across an evening when you're asleep, and you have an idea of your baseline. Then if you have an idea of your baseline, over time, what you can do is you can see, oh, I did a blood sugar balancing diet and my heart rate variability improved. Or I started taking this probiotic and my heart rate variability improved. Or I dealt with this mold infection, or I did a detox diet and my heart rate variability improved. So we can use it for tracking progress in the context of the bigger picture. And we can use it for monitoring improvements. But we can also use it, secondly, day to day, when it comes to balancing out acute stresses. So, for example, I use the Garmin watch a lot in my own journey. And the Garmin watch has got a stress score. So it doesn't necessarily give you a heart rate variability score, but it does give you a stress score, which is based on heart rate variability. So if your stress score is higher, your heart rate variability would be lower, your body would be under more stress. And if your stress score was lower, then you would be under less stress and your heart rate variability would potentially be higher. And so what I love about the Garmin watch is that it measures your in-the-moment level of stress. It's, you know, sitting on my wrist right now as I'm recording this podcast, and it's constantly tracking my heart rate and it's constantly tracking my stress levels. And I love it because if your stress levels are, the stress level score is on a scale of 1 to 100, or 0 to 100. I'm not actually quite sure. I think it's 1. And if you are between 1 and 25, you're in the blue zone. Anything from 26 upwards, you're in the orange zone. So I could look at my watch at any point in time, and as long as that stress score was in the blue, I knew my body was in a good state. And obviously when I'm sitting upright and I'm working and I'm doing something now, like recording a podcast where I'm thinking ahead and I'm trying to speak and I'm trying to not sound like an idiot and make sure that everything comes across really well, there is a high degree of stress here because I'm talking, I'm engaged, I'm thinking, I'm worrying about doing everything correctly. And that's not pathological in any way. That's a normal response to the task at hand. But now if I was to finish recording this podcast and then I'd be like, oh great, I've done the podcast. I'm just going to go and sit outside in the sun for 5 minutes and get away from my screen. I would want to see the stress score come down. But if I then went and I sat down and I started to rest and the stress score still didn't come down, then that could be an indicator that something is wrong. Doesn't necessarily mean that it's related to the task of recording a podcast. It could just have been I ate too much sugar before I recorded the podcast and my body was in a state of stress because of a blood sugar imbalance. But it would say, for example, that something was too much for me at that moment in time. And then I could use that score to work out what was it. Was it just too stressful recording the podcast? Was it something I ate before I recorded the podcast? Was it the fact that I had a really bad night's sleep? Was it the fact that I'm actually really stressed because I'm worrying about a family member? Was it the fact that I actually also did a workout this morning, which was a little bit too intense for me? So we can use the data that we're getting from the HRV readings to also start to work out what helps our body, what supports our body, what allows us to be in parasympathetic tone more of the time, because it's not realistic to be in parasympathetic tone all of the time. And what does the opposite? What heightens the state of stress in the body? Is it food? Is it exercise? Is it the cognitive demands? Is it the emotional demands in our life? And then from gathering the information, we can then start to make assessments about what do we need to do more of? What do we need to do less of? What are the conversations we need to have in our life? What are the boundaries we need to set so that we can have more time in parasympathetic tone and less time in sympathetic tone? But it's usually only once you actually have the device and you start working with the device that you start to get these deeper insights into things that are going on for you. And I'll share some of my personal insights and insights from clients when we talk about how to improve your heart rate variability. And then the third reason that I love heart rate variability, or using the usefulness of heart rate variability, is we can also start to identify early warning signs. So this might not be that moment-to-moment, day-to-day tracking that I've just described, but it could be you're noticing a trend over a number of days. So I mentioned that I use the Garmin watch a lot in my own recovery. The other thing that I adopted really on before it was even that popular was the Oura Ring. And the Oura Ring measures your heart rate variability and your heart rate across the nighttime when you're asleep. So it gives you an indicator of your lowest resting heart rate. And your lowest resting heart rate is the lowest heart rate you achieved across the entire night. And then it gives you your heart rate variability as an average. So what was your average heart rate variability across the night? And the two correlate quite well together. So usually if heart rate variability is higher, heart rate is lower. Or if heart rate variability is lower, heart rate is higher. And so you can kind of start to get a little bit of a picture of what's going on. And say you were measuring every morning when you woke up, you noticed that over time your heart rate was just getting a little bit higher every morning, and your heart rate variability was coming a little bit lower every morning. That can help us to start to intervene before a crash is going to happen, because there's a trend. There might be your body saying, I'm getting a little bit stressed now. I'm still getting a little bit stressed now. I'm really getting stressed now. And if you see that trend happening, you can go, oh, it looks like for the past 3 days, my numbers have been changing. My body, even though I feel okay right now, it looks like my body is under a little bit more stress than what I think I'm under. let me just pull back for a day. And then you can implement the things that you know are supportive for you, you know, whatever that looks like, whether it's more meditation or more yoga or time in nature, or you need to be better with your diet, or you just need to take some things out of your calendar, or, you know, whatever way you self-manage, you really bring in that toolbox and start to implement things that are supportive. And then you can see if that morning reading then improves again, you've re-stabilized the body, and then you can get back into routine. So that can be particularly useful, especially when you're adding in new things. So for example, maybe you're just at the point in your recovery where you're ready to start doing a little bit more exercise, and you've started an exercise routine. And you start your exercise routine and it feels okay to begin with, but then maybe you're doing too much, too many days in a row. And then through monitoring this data, you know, okay, it needs to be one day on, one day off, one day on, one day off, because if I do 2 days together, then my body really starts to get stressed out. Or it might be the case of, I was doing 45 minutes, but actually 25 minutes is enough, then my body doesn't get as stressed out. So these are just examples that I'm using to bring the information to light. But these are ways in which we can use the tracking of heart rate variability to help us make decisions about how we care for ourselves, essentially, and also help us to build connections between what is supportive for us and what is not supportive for us. Because sometimes I'll have these conversations with clients and they're doing various things or not doing various things. And I kind of have an inkling, like, I don't know if that's really a great idea for that person. But I'll ask them and they'll say, no, it's fine. I feel fine when I do that. Or I feel fine when I don't rest as much or pace as much or whatever it might be. And when you have this objective data, you can really start to see what's happening, even if the body feels like it is coping. Sometimes we only realize in hindsight that we weren't actually coping. And the data just helps us maybe to realize a little bit sooner and help us see those warning signs. So now you know a little bit about what HRV is, and you also know how it could potentially be useful for you. So I guess the next question is, how do we measure it? And there are lots of different gadgets and devices and ways that you can measure your HRV, ranging from completely free to much more expensive or higher level of investment and advanced technologies. And as I said, I can only really share experiences with the apps and the technology that I have used. And it's not to say that one method is better than another. I have found the ways that I've done it very, very useful. This is where you might want to talk with your communities online and see what their feedback is, what apps and technologies are they using, what have they found useful, why have they found it useful, how have they found it useful. Compare notes and then think about, given your situation and the challenges that you are experiencing at this stage in your journey, what would be the most supportive choices for you? I've mentioned already that I use the Garmin watch. The reason why I really like it is because it does have that body battery function and stress score. I actually haven't talked about the body battery. I'll talk about that in a moment. But it has the stress score, which enables you to see moment to moment how much stress your body is under. And that helps you see those connections with those acute stresses. So things like exercise, nutrition, supplements, cognitive stress, mental stress, emotional stress, how all of those things are impacting you day to day. But it does also have a function which I haven't mentioned, which is the body battery. The body battery is a battery, so to speak, a theoretical battery. And depending on how high your stress levels are throughout the day, that body battery gets depleted faster. And with lower stress levels, the body battery gets depleted more slowly. And I also found that the body battery was really helpful in my recovery because, being an achiever, I wanted to keep my body battery topped up. And I could see there were certain things that would really drain my battery. And then I would know, okay, well, that's really going to drain my battery. So then I need to do some things which are going to help to recharge that battery. And that really helped me in my own journey with my pacing. But it was a very individual process that I went through. In addition to the Garmin watch, I also use the Oura Ring. As I've mentioned already, that the Oura Ring is a ring, you wear it on your finger, and every night when you go to sleep, it will track your heart rate and heart rate variability. As it also measures your temperature as well, which I quite like for checking for ovulation. And it gives you a readiness score, which is kind of neither here nor there. You really need to interpret the data, which is what I'll talk about in a moment. But it can give you an indicator of how much stress your body is under, because if you see that your heart rate is elevated compared to the norm and your heart rate variability is low compared to the norm, then that can be an indicator that the body is under stress. And I would use that a lot in terms of kind of identifying those early warning signs that I talked about. In terms of identifying the acute stresses, the body battery and the Garmin watch and the stress score was much more useful. But the two together, I personally found, was the best combination. Not everybody would necessarily have the affordability to get both a Garmin watch and an Oura Ring. So what I will share is that you can also look at the data on your Garmin watch, and it will show you your lowest heart rate across the night. And I've found that there's a very strong correlation, like degree of accuracy, between the Oura Ring lowest resting heart rate and the Garmin watch lowest resting heart rate across the night. There's usually only maybe one beat per minute difference between the two, if at all. So given that there's such a high inverse correlation between heart rate variability and heart rate, you can assume that if your heart rate went fairly low across the night, your heart rate variability was also quite high across the night. In which case, if you had to choose one, I would choose the watch, just because you've got other functions in there that you can use throughout the day. You can also track heart rate and exercise. It's a watch. You can use it for watch time telling purposes, other things as well, which can be helpful. Early on in my journey, before I got an Oura Ring, I used the Elite HRV app with a heart rate chest monitor. So the actual app, I believe, is free, but the chest strap will probably cost you about £50 or something on Amazon. So in the morning, before I got up and started doing anything, I would put the chest strap around my chest, sort of just below my breastbone. I would open up the app and I would take the measurement, and then I would get an indicator of what my heart rate and heart rate variability was first thing in the morning. Now, provided you do that as soon as you wake up, that could also be a cheaper alternative to using something like an Oura Ring. And I believe it's the same technology that the Visible app uses. So the other option is to use the Visible app. And they actually use the camera on your phone, where you take your finger and you place your finger over the camera app on your the camera lens on your phone, and it can sense the pulse in your finger. And from there, it will test your heart rate variability, which I just think is so incredible, like this technology that we have these days. But that's also a completely free option. Visible does have a payment thing that you can upgrade to, but you can do the morning readiness score for free using the Visible app. And I believe they do use the same technology as Elite HRV. And then there are other technologies. So there's the Whoop strap, which I have seen some clients who have used the Whoop strap. I personally just didn't like it. I didn't like the way the data was presented, but maybe some other people have found it helpful. Apple Watch also has some similar technology. I'm not an Apple person. I'm more of an Android person, I'm sorry to say. So I can't really comment on the Apple Watch, but the whole point is to find the technologies and the data that helps you. And therefore, you know, obviously it's expensive to buy all sorts of different watches and rings and straps, but I would say start with what's free. If you're thinking of investing in something, see how useful it is. Once you start using the technology, you also start to get a sense of where you feel the holes in the data are. And then you could think about what you would need to fill those holes, and then consider some of the other paid options. So that would probably be a really good place to start. As I've mentioned already, I do really like the Oura Ring as well, because it can tell you, it can give an indicator of where you are in your menstrual cycle. women after ovulation experience a rise in body temperature. So you can see, provided you're an ovulating woman, you can see that you have a lower temperature in the first half of your cycle and then a higher temperature in the second half of your cycle. And I always like that because it helps me track my cycles. But also there are cycle-specific changes in HRV and heart rate that can be helpful to know about as well. So I would typically have a lower heart rate in the first half of my cycle, a slightly higher heart rate in the second half of my cycle. Nothing pathological, just a slight variance, maybe 2 to 4 beats per minute. But it's worth factoring in the impact of your cycles when you're looking at your data and interpreting your data. So it's worth mentioning. And then obviously having the body temperature measure from the Oura Ring allows me to know where I am in my cycle and then adjust accordingly in terms of my interpretation of the data. So that is probably then also just a really nice segue into what is optimal. You now know what heart rate variability is. You know how it can be helpful to you. I've given you some guidance on different devices that you could explore. You've got one of these devices, you're measuring your heart rate variability, and now you're looking at the data and you're thinking, what do I do with this? And so here, there, I want to express that there's obviously science and then there's also an art. And we need to use both when it comes to making the most of this information. There's no optimal HRV per se. Rather, there is what is optimal for you at this stage in your journey, bearing in mind it's something that may change over time. So, for example, if you find that your average HRV is 35 ms, and then someone else may have an average HRV, which is 45 ms. And that might mean that theirs is higher than yours, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything about you. It just means that your average is 35 ms. And that might mean that if your HRV was to drop down to 25, you would know that your body is under stress. If your HRV was to jump up to 45, then we'll talk about this in a moment, that could signal that your body is really in its parasympathetic and you're doing lots of healing. But it could also be a warning sign as well that your body is trying to put on the brakes and slow you down. So if you know that your average HRV is 35, we're just looking for any big fluctuations away from average. To much lower than average might be a warning sign, but much higher than average could also be a warning sign. And therefore, each day you're probably wanting to measure the data and then kind of think about, well, how do I feel today? How is this data correlating with my experience? And how can I keep a log of that in terms of understanding how useful this data is for me? So generally speaking, higher HRV can be a sign that there's more coherence in the nervous system and there's maybe greater resilience and there's a greater ability to manage stress. A lower HRV from your average may indicate more stress, greater sympathetic activity of the autonomic nervous system, and perhaps encouraging more rest, restoration, and recovery. So from a chronic fatigue recovery perspective, days where your HRV is higher, you maybe have the capacity and resilience to do a little bit more. And then days when your HRV is a bit lower, that's maybe when you need to just pare back on your routine. You need to add in more rest and restorative practices, maybe be more mindful about your nutrition and hydration and supplements and those other supportive things. So having an idea of what your average is, and then looking at your deviations from average, can help you make decisions about planning your day, your activity levels, your commitments, your self-care. And additionally, as I've mentioned already, you can track the HRV over time. So maybe average was 35 for you, but then over time, as you've been getting more and more well, you notice that your average is more around 40, and that becomes your new norm. So many devices will give you a monthly average, which can be useful to track progress. Maybe you know, across 1 month, it only goes from 35 to 36, but over a year, maybe you see a significant improvement, or you see that there are more good days, so more days when you're at average versus low. And maybe overall, you're noticing that in correlation with that, that your capacity is expanding, which is what we all want. So here, I just wanted to caution that a higher HRV is not always better. And it took me a really long time to learn this lesson, and I had to learn it the hard way. I had my Oura Ring, I was tracking my heart rate and heart rate variability. And what I noticed is that every single month, when my menstrual cycle came, my heart rate would plummet and my heart rate variability would go really, really high. So to give you an idea is, usually my heart average, my overnight heart rate would probably be about 50, 51, 52, give or take. My heart rate variability would be in the 40s, shall we say. And around my menstrual cycle, my heart rate could go at times as low as 45. And my heart rate variability could go at times, I think the highest is probably about 80. So actually almost double. And in my naivety, I would see these numbers. Oh, look how low my heart rate is. Oh, look how high my heart rate variability is. I must be really full of capacity today. I should be able to go out and do everything and exercise. And that was not the case. At those times were often the times when I felt the worst, the lowest in energy, the most brain foggy, the most headachey. And I couldn't understand it. I was thinking, why does my data look so good and I yet feel so rubbish? And the real take-home understanding here, which I only really got clarity around after speaking with Harry from Visible, was that this is about stability. And it makes complete sense. Because if you've listened to some of my previous episodes, I talk about how in these chronic illness, syndromal pattern conditions, the system is a system which needs stability. And therefore, a lot of what we do, at least in the beginning stages of working with a chronic illness, is we do all the things that stabilize the system. And if we're seeing now, in terms of data, a massive swing in the data, what we're essentially seeing is an unstable system. If we've swung so far away from average, we've swung away from the point of stability. So where my point of stability was at 50, 51, 52, maybe 53, maybe 49, but roughly about 40 to low 50s heart rate variability, that was my range of stability that I was only really able to kind of determine over time through experience. Anything kind of coming outside of that range was starting to signal instability within my system. And something I get asked all the time is people ask about why they get flares during their menstrual cycle or just before their cycle or just after their cycle. Obviously, at this point in time, we're experiencing a massive fluctuation in hormones. Estrogen has probably gone from quite high to quite low as we experience the onset of menstruation. And those hormonal changes, specifically if your hormones are already imbalanced, those hormonal changes create more instability within an unstable system. And so then, in the context of the example I've been using with you, is my estrogen levels would go high, they would crash, my system would respond with instability, and then the parasympathetic system would kick in because the parasympathetic system is like the brake. When we're thinking about healthy parasympathetic, it's sort of applying the brakes on the sympathetic system, but more of a free state is like a handbrake. So when my heart rate would drop really low and my heart rate variability would go really high, you can think of that as like a handbrake. Like, this system is menstruating. It is too unstable. We need you to slow down. We need you to stop. We need you to do less. We need you to rest. We need you to pay attention until this time is over and you are more stable again. For so long, I did not honor that because I didn't understand it. and I would continue to push through too early in my cycle. And then the crash wouldn't necessarily be as my period arrived. It would be the week after. And what I learned is that the more I could rest and the more I could honor the need for slowing down during the first 3 days, at least the first 3 days of menstruation, the better my cycles would get as a whole. And as I said, I mean, women have a cycle every month, and it took me years to learn to do this. And now it's something I'm really mindful of, that when I menstruate, still to this day, always do my best to take the first 3 days really, really easy. And obviously, I'm still tracking the Aura data, so I can pay attention to what my body needs and make sure that I honor it. So if you are a woman, perhaps that little anecdote was very insightful for you. But even if you're not a woman, the main take-home point here is any massive deviation from the mean is a sign of instability in the system. Syndromal systems, chronic illness systems, are inherently unstable. And so therefore you can think of that deviation as a request for more stability. And I've done a whole podcast episode on this, which you can listen to, but the things that help to stabilize the system are going to be your nutrition, your sleep routine, pacing, dealing with infections, toxins, traumas, and also just stabilizing your blood sugar and stabilizing your physical, cognitive, and mental stress throughout the day. Which then brings us to the next piece of this, which is, how do we improve our heart rate variability? And this is where there's this overlap with stability. And the things which help us to stabilize our system are likely also going to be the things that help us to stabilize our heart rate variability and grow it over time. So I've got some personal shares, I've got some shares from clients, but the main things that are going to be most useful will be optimizing your sleep, making sure you're getting enough sleep in terms of quality and quantity. I appreciate that when you are unwell, sleep can be a bit of an elusive dream, excuse the pun, but we do need to find ways to sleep, and a huge part of that is also stabilizing our light, dark exposure and our circadian rhythms. Exercise. So exercise can actually help to improve our heart rate variability, but we know with chronic illness, it's very easy to over-exercise and that can decrease it. Nutrition can have a profound impact on heart rate variability. Things like blood sugar and anti-inflammatory foods can be beneficial, and I've seen that with myself and clients, and I'll talk about that more. Learning to manage our mental and emotional stress load can help to improve our heart rate variability. There have been people who've done my Nurturing Resilience program who've had Oura rings, who've said that their Oura ring data improved across the program. There can also be, we need to deal with physical stresses. So infections, toxins, blood sugar imbalances, alcohol, smoking, caffeine will all have an impact on heart rate variability. Certain supplements can impact heart rate variability. And then hormetic stresses like fasting, cold stress, so cold water exposure, heat stress like sauna, can also impact heart rate variability. I think these things are so dependent on the individual. So each person will respond differently to different things depending on their own physiology. And in the case of hormetic stresses like heat stress, cold stress, fasting, exercise, the dosage for that specific system is going to be really, really important. But for the most part, I think if you're looking to improve your heart rate variability, start with those factors that help you stabilize your system, and that's sleep, activity and rest pacing, nutrition, and nervous system support. What I'd like to do before I finish up today is just talk a little bit more about some of the things that I've observed, and also just share some of my observations from working with clients as well. And the first thing on that list, which may come as no surprise, is nutrition. And the two biggest things that I think make a difference on heart rate variability when it comes to nutrition is optimal blood sugar balance. So making sure that your blood sugar is balanced throughout the day, but most importantly, off the back of your evening meal, because that's also going to affect your sleep quality and quantity as well. So in my own journey, I would track my Oura Ring data overnight. And what I learned from doing that was if I had an evening meal that was destabilizing for my body, either because there was too much carbohydrate or overall it was more of an inflammatory food choice, I would notice a reduced heart rate variability and an increased heart rate overnight. And I would definitely feel more groggy and brain foggy the next day. And so what I learned from that, you know, in the context of this episode and using the data to support me, was that if I wanted to have a treat food, which should be few and far between, especially when you're in the early stages of your health challenge and you're looking to achieve stability, that treat is better had earlier in the day versus nighttime. Because if you have a treat earlier in the day and you are able to do some movement to offset some of the blood sugar imbalances, you can re-stabilize by the evening and you don't have that negative impact on sleep. Food is obviously a bit of a funny one because a lot of people can have a lot of emotional attachments to food. And I do notice I have certain types of clients. Some are just like, I'll do whatever it takes. I'm going to just go straight in. I don't care what I need to give up. I just need to get better. And then some people are just like, they're really resistant to making dietary changes, or they struggle to be consistent because there's a lot of emotion overcoupled with their food choices. And in which case we really need to work with that emotional overcoupling, which is more somatic work, before we can actually get down to the business of optimizing the diet. The other thing which I've observed with clients, a lot of my clients more recently, in fact, have been needing to do the autoimmune paleo diet because they have autoimmunity. And even though this is like the diet nobody wants to do, apart from a low histamine diet, I think it's one of the hardest diets to do, or possibly carnivore as well. They've noticed that their heart rate variability has improved when they've cut out some of those more pro-inflammatory foods. And so this is when I'm talking about pro-inflammatory foods, I'm not talking about gluten and dairy and sugar and processed seed oils. I'm talking about things that would probably be considered healthy for a normal system, like lectins or nightshade vegetables. So we would think that nuts and seeds and vegetables are healthy, and they are, but for some systems, they can still be very pro-inflammatory and they can impact the HRV data. So it's always good to know that that's something worth trying if you're feeling, if you're noticing after every meal your body is going into a state of stress. We either need to optimize for digestion of food, we need to optimize for blood sugar, or we need to optimize for the quality or the types of foods. There could be some food reactions happening. So then the next thing is just talking about supplements, because supplements can impact HRV. I always notice certain things that I just take, for example, glutathione or something like anti-inflammatories like curcumin. Whenever I take those, I do notice a drop in my heart rate and an increase in my heart rate variability straight after. Also, specific nervous system calming nutrients like L-theanine or lemon balm, I also notice that difference with it. But the research suggests that the following may be beneficial for improving HRV, and that's CoQ10, omega-3 fish oils, magnesium, rhodiola, ashwagandha, probiotics, L-carnitine, vitamin D, and curcumin. I don't have a lot of experience with these personally. I don't have many clients reporting back on these specifically, but I would just say that these are just, if you're taking any of these, to just try and see. I personally feel that supplements are supplementary, so they are the cherry on top. We can't really expect to take a little bit of vitamin D and hope that it will change our HRV if we're still eating a pro-inflammatory diet, if our blood sugar is still imbalanced. So you're more likely to be sensitive to the impact of these supplements when some of those other basic stabilizing factors are well and truly in place. It's worth mentioning alcohol. I think a lot of people with chronic illness have worked out that alcohol doesn't agree with them. So I don't really have a lot of clients who drink, but I do have a few. And it can be helpful to understand that one drink can actually sometimes create an increase in heart rate variability because it can be a little bit more calming on the nervous system. But too much alcohol can send things the other way. And especially if you are someone with a chronic illness, if you have a nervous system that's more sensitive and unstable, even small amounts of alcohol may be destabilizing for the nervous system. And what I always tell my clients is there's no amount of alcohol that is good for your brain. Then finally, I thought we'd talk a little bit about exercise. I've mentioned already that regular exercise can actually, as fitness improves, as the endurance and the function of the heart muscle improves, we can see an increase in heart rate variability because we know that as someone's cardiovascular fitness improves, resting heart rate decreases over time. So in a healthy person, engaging in regular cardiovascular activity can be important for enhancing parasympathetic tone and reducing stress. But in chronic illness, exercise is a double-edged sword because exercise needs to be appropriately tailored for the individual at their current level of capacity. And that line is very fine between just enough and too much. And so if exercise is too intense, if it goes on for too long, if it exceeds the individual's capacity, it can then be a source of inflammation and oxidative stress in the body, and that will suppress your HRV. And this is where having a wearable device can be really helpful to give you that feedback. I know that when I was first starting to exercise in my own journey, often the day after a gym training session, my heart rate variability would be a little bit low. But then I would know to rest the next day, it would rebalance itself. And then I was able to stay in that place of just stressing my body enough and then pulling it back. And then just stressing my body enough and then pulling it back. But that balance is very, very fine. Additionally, with my Garmin watch, I would also notice that after exercise, my stress score would go high for several hours afterwards. And if I did too much, it would stay high. So I kind of know now with my exercise, I need to exercise at a pace that will allow my heart rate variability to be impacted. So the Garmin stress score increases, but that stress score should come down again. If I was to come back from the gym and I was to eat and I was to have a little rest, then it should come back down again. And that's how I know, that's how I make sure I don't overtrain and I stay within my capacity with training. So the last thing I just wanted to touch on is hormetic stresses. So heat stress, cold stress, and fasting. Just a few more anecdotes about my own experiences here. Essentially, hormetic stresses refer to a mild and beneficial stress that, when applied in the right dosage, stimulates a positive adaptive response that will lead to improved resilience and overall health. So exercise, which I've already talked about, is a hormetic stress. We know that when we apply exercise at the right dosage, the body adapts, it gets stronger, and then over time we can do more. And the same is true in the context of heat stress, cold stress, and fasting. If we are able to tolerate a small amount of heat and we expose ourselves to heat like a sauna at the right dosage, over time, we should be able to expose ourselves to more and more and more and more. Same for cold, same for fasting or food abstinence. So hormetic stresses, these heat stress, cold stress, fasting stresses, have similar adaptation processes to exercise. And in my journey, I definitely dabbled with these. Cold water swimming, dipping, and cold showers were something that I did very regularly as part of my own recovery. And what I would notice is that actually being submerged in cold water would increase my stress score on my Garmin watch. But then afterwards, my body would go into like a really nice parasympathetic tone. And that was something that I also observed when walking. If I would go out for a walk, when I came back and I settled, my body would go very, very parasympathetic for 30 minutes to an hour afterwards. So when we use these hormetic stresses, provided we can tolerate them and we don't overwhelm the system, they can actually be ways in which we can access the parasympathetic system, or we can achieve more parasympathetic tone. But if we do too much, the opposite happens. So if the walk or the exercise was too intense, if the cold water was too cold and I stayed in for too long, then it would potentially flip that switch. And instead of going parasympathetic afterwards, my body would then go into more of a sympathetic response afterwards. And that could potentially stress me out for the whole day, lead to an energy crash further on in the day. I also did use heat, especially with mold. One of the ways we need to overcome mold and mycotoxin exposure is we need to sweat the toxins out. So sauna is a big part of the process, but a lot of people can't tolerate sauna. And sometimes when we increase our heat exposure, we also release a lot of toxins at once, which can be overwhelming for the body. So getting the dosage right is really, really important. And this is where I kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, is that I found that I didn't tolerate sauna. And I would get a lot of post-exertional malaise after sauna. And so I thought that, okay, just because now I can't tolerate a 30-minute sauna, that I shouldn't do sauna at all. And I had my own infrared sauna at home, which I sold, which I now regret. But what I should have done at the time was just leave my ego behind and just do 5 minutes, or just get used to hot baths, or just do 3 minutes, and then gradually, gently build up over time. So that small amount of stress exposure wasn't then creating more stress in my body afterwards. Sometimes it's nice just to get a little bit warm, get a little bit hot, get a bit of a sweat on, get out before you create too much stress on the body. So I feel like that sauna story is probably a little bit misplaced when talking about heart rate variability, but it is just to highlight the fact that just because we can't do something doesn't mean we shouldn't do it at all. It's just maybe checking in with how much we're doing and then reevaluating. I think the biggest thing is just leaving your ego behind and, you know, thinking, oh, because I can't exercise for 30 minutes, it doesn't mean I shouldn't exercise at all. But actually this little tiny dose, whatever is tolerable, can have this beneficial effect on the body and help to swing the body back to more parasympathetic tone. And I think when you've got the data, because you're using some sort of tracking device and you can see, oh, I did this, it was stressful, but then my body came back to a resting state, then that can be encouraging. And that's another reason why having the data can be so helpful. So this has actually been a really long episode. I see we're coming up to almost an hour now. So I've pretty much been through everything that I wanted to say. I hope you found this useful. You know, I don't really feel like I'm a massive expert when it comes to the topic of heart rate variability, but I do feel that I've learned a lot from my own journey, and I've learned enough clearly that I could share in terms of almost an hour's worth of content for you. I would love to get Harry on the show from Visible when he's available, and we'll probably have more of a conversation about heart rate variability and talk about the Visible app more specifically. But in the meantime, if you haven't already left a review for the podcast, I really appreciate it if you could just take a moment, leave me 5 stars on iTunes or Spotify. I think on iTunes, you can leave a little written paragraph if you'd like to give some positive feedback. This is a self-funded podcast, so, you know, there's no ads, nothing to get in the way of your listening experience, and it's all paid for, all the editing and hosting and the time and the energy is all paid for by me. So I would really appreciate it if you could show your appreciation and leave a review, and also share with anybody who you think would find this useful, because the more people who share the podcast, it creates a wider listening base, which means there's even more people to share the podcast. And then the word gets out and more people get the help and support that they need. And I do get such wonderful feedback every single week of people saying how much this podcast has helped them. So you passing the love on by sharing this with someone would mean the world to me. So I will wrap up here. Thank you so much for listening. And I'll see you in the next episode.